You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of May 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Nina Schick and George Brock will join me to look at the big stories of the day, including Vladimir Putin's visit to Russia, a case of friendly fire in the propaganda war over Ukraine, the imminent European elections, and whether or not American students are entitled to trigger warnings ahead of studying potentially distressing literature. Short answer, no. Also ahead,
turning it through, it's on here now, the goalkeeper's beaten, and South Africa have their
We wonder why South Africa's World Cup build-up was rather smoother than Brazil's appears to have been, and Mike Flynn from Jazzwise will give us a rundown of this week's Jazzy Beats. All that, plus a check-in with our man in Milan. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. A characteristically action-packed 60 minutes ahead then, but before all of that, James Luckhurst has the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News. Thailand's army has declared martial law across the country to restore order after 6 months of street protests that have left the country without a proper functioning government. However, Army Chief General Prayuth Chan-o-cha insisted the surprise intervention was not a military coup. He said the military had stepped in to restore order and build investor confidence and warned that troops would take action against anyone who used weapons and harmed civilians. Two loud explosions have been heard near a crowded market in the central Nigerian city of Jos. Correspondents say many casualties are feared because the market was crowded at the time. Aid agencies are warning that South Sudan is facing the threat of a famine on a bigger scale than that seen in Ethiopia in the 1980s. The warning comes as Britain, Norway and the United States have pledged millions of dollars at a conference in Oslo to help alleviate a humanitarian crisis in the country. European Union antitrust regulators have charged HSBC, JP Morgan and Credit Agricole with rigging financial benchmarks linked to the euro. The move followed a record €1.7 billion fine levied on six banks, including Deutsche Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland and Citigroup last December for similar offences. The EU's antitrust chief is Joaquin Almunia.
We have now reached the preliminary conclusion that these three banks may have participated in this cartel too, if confirmed. Such behavior would be a breach of our antitrust rules that prohibit anti-competitive agreements, and in particular cartels. The three banks have now the opportunity to defend themselves. We will look carefully at all their arguments before taking any final decision.
The three banks could face penalties of up to 10% of their global turnover if found guilty of breaching EU antitrust rules. A man who travelled to Syria from the UK to join rebels fighting President Bashar al-Assad has become the first person in Britain to be convicted of a terrorism offence relating to the conflict. Mashudur Chowdhury, who's 31, travelled to the country with four others in October, but was arrested when he returned alone later that month. He's been found guilty of engaging in conduct in preparation for terrorist acts after a 12-day trial at Kingston Crown Court in London. He'll be sentenced next month. The far-right Dutch Freedom Party leader Geert Wilders has staged an anti-EU event outside the European Parliament in Brussels. Mr. Wilders cut a star off an EU flag, saying it symbolised the Netherlands recovering its independence 5 days before citizens from all over the 28-member bloc had called to the polls to elect new representatives at the European Parliament. Mr. Wilders also called for the Netherlands to stop welcoming refugees and to close its borders.
I believe the elections will be historic because in many countries, from France to the United Kingdom to many other countries in Europe, the Eurosceptical parties will, I hope and I am confident about, will make a major win. So the voice both of the Eurosceptics in Brussels, but also in the national parliaments, I think will be an historic change.
Polls indicate populist parties could win about 30% of the 751 seats in Parliament, up from 21% in the outgoing Parliament, according to the Brussels-based think tank Open Europe. And US authorities have resumed a search for four British sailors missing in the Atlantic Ocean after an appeal from the British public and UK politicians. Prime Minister David Cameron welcomed the renewed search for the crew of the Cheeky Rafiki, who've been missing since Friday. And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you, James. You're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. To vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, which will be 13.06 in New York, which isn't that difficult to pronounce. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are Nina Schick from Open Europe and George Brock, head of the journalism department at Sydney University. Welcome to you both. We will start with Vladimir Putin's state visit to China. The Russian president arrived in Shanghai earlier today. He's attending the summit of the Conference on Interaction and Confidence Building Measures in Asia, which sounds like a hoot. And Chinese state media say that a substantial statement will be made by Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. Nina, to you first, do we have any idea what a substantial announcement might be?
Well, everyone is wondering whether or not China and Russia will agree for some kind of gas deal. And this is, of course, a broader push by Russia to move away from dependency upon Europe, because, of course, the EU is Russia's biggest trading partner. However, it's important to point out that these talks between Russia and China have actually been going on for the past 10 years. And if it is actually a gas deal that they're talking about, the infrastructure for that is not yet in place. So it's a much longer term strategic interest, which Russia is trying to pursue as it tries to move away from the EU.
It does. I mean, there's been an awful lot of talk recently, for obvious reasons, about EU trying to move away from energy dependence on Russia. Is it the same reason why Russia is trying to distance itself from the EU?
Yes, I mean, they're uncomfortable bed partners. The EU is, as you mentioned, trying to move away from energy dependency from Russia. But again, the infrastructure is simply not in place. The EU is still 30% dependent on Russia for its oil and gas needs. And that is not bound to change in the next few years, although it is already significantly lower than what it once was. But as Russia turns to China, again, those gas pipes are not in place. And as the EU turns to other countries like the US for its gas needs, again, the infrastructure is not in place. So again, longer term strategic interest by Russia.
On the subject of unlikely bedfellows there, George Brock, it's not like Russia and China's relationship is one you can take for granted either. Putin has called China Russia's reliable friend, which is the sort of thing one says before international summits, but in this case is obvious nonsense. But he does say that the cooperation between them right now is at the highest level in history, which may not be saying much, but is that at least true?
It's true until they fall out over the gas price. This is really mostly about money, not about cultural politics. Putin is a long-standing expert at making people he doesn't like feel uncomfortable. He's really very good at this. And he's probably enjoying, when he's in Beijing or Shanghai or wherever he is...
People Vladimir Putin doesn't like
is a broad spectrum. It's a lot of people. This is a big group. He can continue working on this project for some years. And he's enjoying a little bit of discomfiture in the West as he's doing this. But he's not so stupid as to know that, A, he doesn't have much if they don't actually cut a deal about the gas. And as Nina rightly says, they've been arguing about this for a very long time, and their first shot at this meeting didn't work. Failed. The Chinese obviously been very tough about the price. And the second thing is that everybody, Putin knows as well as everybody else, that actually over the centuries, and certainly in the 20th century, the relations between China and Russia were wary at the very best description.
Well, indeed. Nina was talking there about the focus, I guess, at these talks may have been lent by Russia's recent sort of invasion of Ukraine. But how enthused or otherwise is China likely to be about Russia's adventure in Ukraine? Because obviously they can't criticise the reabsorption of Crimea because of Taiwan, but they can't get too excited about self-determination for Ukraine because of Tibet.
as you so rightly hint, I don't actually think that Putin is going to be telling Xi Jinping what an absolutely wonderful thing is going on at the moment in Donetsk, for example. Because separatism, whatever angle you're looking at it from, either way, is not really something the Chinese much like hearing about. And they're much more worried about separatism without their, in their own territory than they are inside their own territory, Tibet, for example, than they are about something like Taiwan. Taiwan is a very, very long project for the Chinese, but they've got stroppy, ugly situations in places like Tibet and their Muslim minority areas already. So I think that the language that is coming out of the official Chinese press about this is very, very unexcited about that aspect of it. It's China is very good at being very peaceful. It makes people behave well. It's calm. It's all language like that. Not encouraging excitable people to go and split countries in half. Definitely not.
Well, coming back to you, Nina, and I guess looking at the same thing from the other way around, is Russia likely to be bothered one way or the other about China's recent assertiveness verging on belligerence in the South China Sea?
Well, I think with Russia, they'll pursue their interests first and foremost. So they'll say whatever they have to say in order to get what they want to get. And the interest, this raises the interesting question about how far is China willing to go to support Russia internationally. Now, when that vote was taken in Crimea, China notably didn't vote in the UN Security Council. Whether or not this is just a shift in rhetoric and whether that'll actually be followed up by action in the international arena remains to be seen. But as George correctly pointed out, ultimately it comes down to pure economics. And whereas Russia traditionally was waiting on China to come to them for their massive natural resources, the fact that now Russia is going to China to try and cut a gas deal is an interesting development in itself.
Is this purely a partnership, if it is to be a partnership of convenience? Is there any at all, right now, these days, any ideological fellow feeling between Russia and China? Do we know if even at a personal level, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping like each other?
Well, I think there's a certain correspondence that they may have in the sense that they feel that they might be standing up to Western oppression or Western dictatorship. So the US and the EU dictating to China and Russia how things should go. But aside from that, I think, I mean, China is also, you know, purely looking out for its economic interests. So again, it will be a marriage based on convenience.
And coming back to you, George, do you think, I mean, once Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping actually get in a room, do they actually have anything in common at all at this point, the two countries, the two leaders, other than a certain economic dependence on each other?
No, they have some convergence, possibly, of interest. But I repeat, the geopolitics are much, much less important than is the money. Money and energy, this is what this is really about. The rest is just word packaging for the deal they have to try and cut.
Well, on the subject of word packaging, we will return to Russia for our next story tonight. And this is back in Russia, where at least one participant in the information war raging around Ukraine appears to have shot themselves in the foot. A news report on the very much pro-Kremlin All-Russia State Television showed footage of a recent anti-Russian violent outburst of violence in Ukraine, which was swiftly rumbled as film of an obscure shootout in the North Caucasus, which was filmed 2 years ago. Now, Dmitry Kiselyov, the deputy head of the network, said it was an accident, a result, he said, of computer error or, and I quote, somewhat bemusedly, mistake by young nymphs in video editing. Are we buying that? I'll ask you first.
Certainly not. I think I think with the pro-Russian television media reports, it's widely known that they have been falsifying reports, and this is a huge embarrassment for them. But again, with the annexation of Crimea, there were reports like this filtering around as well, showing supposed protesters or Russian minority groups being oppressed by the Kiev authorities. And again, this is just simply continuation of Russia pursuing its own interests in Ukraine.
George, to turn to you, I guess, any journalist who has covered any conflict at all at any level knows, or at least should know, that the one absolutely ironclad rule of any such thing is that everybody's lying. about absolutely everything at all times, or at least that's the assumption you should make. What I guess I'm asking is that this particular war, which has happened almost in real time on social media, are people now lying in new and exciting ways, or is it the same varieties of lies repackaged?
As the stakes get higher, so the lies multiply in almost any situation, such as the one in Crimea. I'm not sure that it's necessary to do with social media. I actually think we go further back in the past to explain this. I'm sorry that your listeners can't see a picture of Mr. Kiselyov, because if you saw a picture of Mr. Kiselyov with his buzz cut, you would know that he stood in a long tradition of Soviet spokesmen who sit solemnly in front of a large press conference and tell you that black is white.
Or that 2 + 2 = 5,
precisely.
Indeed. It's not like Western outlets are entirely immune to this kind of thing. Has their coverage, and I'll stick with you for this next one, George, has their coverage been any noticeably less skewed, or have Western outlets been too keen to buy the narrative we were presented with of sort of liberal freedom fighters in the Maidan?
Western journalists would be always well advised when they're in a very dangerous, flexible, fluid situation of this kind, not to say we are perfect, but to point up their difference with broadcasting and journalism in authoritarian areas, which is that in an open society, journalists are more easily corrected and accountable. There was a lot of very, very romantic reporting about departure from the Russian sphere of influence for the Ukraine and so on in the early days, but it died away extremely quickly. As soon as people got on the ground, and particularly as soon as they got on the ground in eastern Ukraine, and realized that actually street by street, down at human level, this was going to be extremely tough. There was a very long history of this being a society, Ukraine, I mean, looking both ways, part of it looking west, part of it looking east, and that it was going to be at a human level extremely difficult and very dangerous. But that, I think, actually, that adaptation took place very quickly. The fact is, journalists can't all be experts in everything, and the number of people who were expert in Ukraine was pretty small. So what happens is people arrive and they do a crash course.
Nina, I'm wondering what you made of it, because it strikes me, and I haven't recently been to Ukraine or indeed Egypt, but I've covered similar situations, and it strikes me that it's a mistake I'm sure I've been guilty of myself, which is that journalists, Western journalists, will tend to gravitate in a situation like that to the people who remind them of themselves, which is why everybody's surprised when the Egyptian revolution turns out not to be a victory for, you know, Western-oriented, secular, liberal kids in cool jeans and trainers, and everybody again seems surprised when, you know, Ukraine goes spiraling off in some direction nobody could have predicted. Do you think that is a problem, that we still seek to impose Western narratives on these things in our reporting?
Absolutely. And I think that extends far beyond reporting. I mean, part of the reason why this whole crisis started in the first place was because the EU as an institution viewed Ukraine through that romantic lens where they were trying to bring Ukraine closer for more EU integration, not taking consideration of the very deep economic, historical and political ties that Ukraine still has to Russia. And that is one of the reasons why, before the protests started in the Maidan, when the EU leaders were asked by Putin to come to the negotiating table and negotiate a deal through three-party talks, the EU refused, which then led to the protests. So I think that binary lens of seeing countries like Ukraine through, and also our own Western biases percolate not only through the media, but through society as a whole.
How big an influence, though, do you think any media outlet, especially a partisan one, can have? We had a very good report in a recent print edition of Monocle magazine from Inside RT, Russia Today, by our foreign editor Steve Bloomfield. And it's fairly obviously a very, very partisan setup, a very pro-Moscow setup. But does it actually make any difference to anything? Because surely the only people who are going to watch it are the people who, by and large, agree with it's what it's going to say anyway. People are just carrying on believing what they want to believe.
Certainly. I mean, the interesting thing is ever since the crisis started in Ukraine, President Putin's popularity has skyrocketed across Russia. And of course, that has a lot to do with the media reports that they're being faced with. So the pro-Russian state television. And similarly, as George mentioned, when the Ukraine crisis first started kicking off, there was quite a perhaps romanticized view from the Western media as well. But as George rightfully mentioned, I think that's starting to change here as well.
And George, is there a way for the bewildered onlooker trying to figure out what's actually going on in Ukraine to figure out what's actually going on in Ukraine? There are now so many sources to choose from.
Well, you certainly wouldn't start with the Russian media, that's for sure. But, one of the things that undermines broadcasting in authoritarian regimes obviously is social media, which gives a much higher velocity to information, even if some of it is rubbish and some of it is right, and it doesn't help you, the speed and quantity in which it arrives doesn't help you tell what is true. But one of the problems in Russia is that I think official stations doing Putin propaganda actually are influential, partly because not everybody does have access to another version. So that profusion of information may give us a what's really true here problem here. Unfortunately, that is not necessarily the problem that they have in Russia, if you see what I mean. Maybe the intelligentsia in St. Petersburg and Moscow think, oh, I've got many different sources, but that's not necessarily the case elsewhere. But the fact is that one of the reasons why in the social media age, all the institutions of journalism have not fallen down, dissolved, and collapsed, is that actually trust and record of being believed, even if imperfect, does actually count for people. They tend to believe the things they believed last time, the people they trusted last time.
For the moment, George Brock, thank you very much. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Millett, Nina Schick, and George Brock. When we return, we will be looking ahead to the European elections.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Nina Schick and George Brock. Now, we're slightly less than 48 hours from the opening of polls across Europe in the 2014 European elections. In Britain, at least, the build-up has been largely dominated by a threatened surge by UKIP, a party of tiresome xenophobes who have spent this afternoon attempting to hold a multiracial carnival in Croydon to demonstrate that some of their best friends are etc. etc. Unsurprisingly, reports suggest that the event has not been a triumph, with the Steel Drum Band refusing to play once they'd realised who'd booked them. But it does beg the wider question of why Euro elections attract and even accommodate extremists and outright kooks. Nina, I'll ask you first, is this a problem across Europe?
Oh, absolutely. And this is going to be one of the big, big stories surrounding the European parliamentary elections. We actually looked at all the kind of anti-EU, populist, anti-immigrant, anti-establishment parties that are running. And according to our projections, we think 31% of the seats in the European Parliament could be won by these parties. Now, we have the Front National in France. We have countries like Geert Wilders' Freedom Party in the Netherlands, the Danish People's Party in Denmark. And these are all countries that have been leading the polls. And in some countries like Greece and Hungary, you have even more extreme parties, which are outright fascist parties that have also been doing well in the polls. So this is certainly not a problem that is only UK-centric. We're seeing this across Europe.
Is it just the case, and this is perhaps only my own personal pet theory, that because no one really cares who wins European elections and no one really knows who their MEPs are, voters tend to see European elections as a slightly safe arena in which they can throw a tantrum without it having any particular consequence?
Well, I think it's a larger symptom of the existentialist crisis that the EU as a whole has been going through, also due to the euro crisis, etc., etc. A lot of the problems that has been facing Europe, anti-austerity, anti-immigration, etc., etc. So this is largely this protest vote or malcontent vote. That's exactly what it is. It's a protest against the status quo.
George Brock, what do you think? Because the other thing that everyone worries about before European elections is turnout, which varies hugely. In 2009, it was something like 90% in Belgium and Luxembourg, and barely one person in five, across quite a lot of Eastern Europe. In the UK, it will probably be about 30% if we're lucky this time. At what point does this become an actual crisis of legitimacy?
Oh, I think it's already a crisis of legitimacy. It's not in the future, it's in the present. Don't forget that in some countries voting is compulsory. It's you're supposed to do it under the law. The penalties aren't very serious if you don't vote, but that's the one that tends to drive it up into the 90s. And so really, if you want to know what the true level of interest in these elections is, you need to count the average in the countries where it's not legally compulsory. I'm sorry. And that indicates to you that the voters of Europe long ago realized that this wasn't a body that was very important. And as you say, sometimes they use it as a protest objective. It's now going to become a lot. The paradox, of course, is that with all these parties piling in and probably getting a larger share of the vote, what's going to happen? It's going to become a much more interesting parliament than it was before.
Interesting, of course, is a relative concept. Is the danger then? I ask you, Nina Schick, that the European Parliament will just become, you know, basically a taxpayer-funded nuthouse?
Well, there's several points to make here. So the European Parliament as an institution has actually become more and more powerful over the decades through the significant treaty changes. However, the voter turnout on average is declining. So when the first European parliamentary elections were held in the 70s, voter turnout was 63% across the EU as a whole. Last time, 2009, it was 43%, so significantly declined. However, if you look at the data that's actually released by the European Commission, that does not correlate to voter interest. So that means that if you are interested in European affairs, that doesn't make you more or less likely to vote, which is very interesting because people will say people aren't voting in these elections because they have no idea what's going on. But that's not the case. So again, I think this is much more a sign of the malcontent or the discontent, given the crisis that Europe has been in, that people are struggling to connect with the European institutions.
That's the European elections, which begin 48 hours from now in Britain, across the rest of Europe after that. And I, for one, am struggling to contain my excitement. I'm sure you're the same. It feels appropriate to introduce our last item with a so-called trigger warning, which is to say that listeners hypersensitive to extreme silliness may wish to give us 5 minutes. Students at several American universities are clamoring for trigger warnings in literature courses, which is to say the ability to be excused studying works which may remind them of some personal unpleasantness. George, I'll ask you first, if your students came to you with this idea, how would you respond?
I would do my absolute best not to be too vituperative or critical, but my response would be, not on your life, don't be silly.
It does seem, well, I mean, it's hard to know where to start. Surely the point of any art being to actually trigger an emotional response. Nina, is this as silly as it sounds?
Absolutely. I mean, that is, of course, the whole point of literature, to introduce you to uncomfortable ideas, ideas that can expand your intellectual curiosity. So this is absolutely silly, and I can't... where do you draw the line?
Well, again, this is one of the many questions that asked. I mean, you can't. Yeah, it is quite baffling. But I mean, I think having dispensed with this as a sensible idea, where did this come from? Where did the cult of the trigger warning appear from?
I think that this is American students training to become lawyers, and I think they've gone on an internship at a big law firm, and the law firm has said, okay, the one of you that can bring about the most absurd policy change in your university gets the next high-paid job in our firm.
I'm also wondering, and I'll put this to you, Nina, is there a social media, or is there a sense in which social media has amplified this? It has become a fantastic arena for the professionally indignant, for people who spend their lives charging around looking for something to get upset about.
Yeah, and I think that this is, again, another case of kind of political correctness gone mad. Again, I refer to my earlier point, where do you draw the line? I mean, you could say that anything offends you, so... again, I think this is an absolutely crazy story.
But if some American university was to actually adopt this policy, which does not seem altogether impossible, this is American academia we're talking about, almost nothing is actually impossible, what effect would it have?
Well, I certainly hope that their student recruitment would start to fall. And people would not take them as seriously as they have done in the past. Let's not forget that when you get big accelerations in the way people communicate, such as the freedom and opportunity to use social media to pass information around, you get a lot of stupidity and idiocy at the beginning. And then it starts to fall off. People start to get sensible again. Maybe boring, may sound a little dull, but actually, in human history, that's what tends to happen.
Nina?
I guess it's also worth pointing out that these were suggestions made by several student bodies in several universities. So I think we're quite far off from it actually becoming policy across American universities.
No, oh, I wish I shared your optimism. We will have to leave it there. Nina Schick from Open Europe, George Brock, head of the journalism department at City University here in London. Thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monaco 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Milan. We'll ask whether Brazil is doing the World Cup wrong, or at least well than South Africa. And also, trigger warning, there'll be jazz. But before we get started on all that, James Luckhurst has the headlines.
Thailand's army has declared martial law across the country to restore order after 6 months of street protests that have left the country without a proper functioning government. However, Army Chief General Prayuth Chan-o-cha has insisted the surprise intervention was not a military coup. Two loud explosions have been heard near a crowded market in the central Nigerian city of Jos. Correspondents say at least 10 people have been killed. Aid agencies are warning that South Sudan is facing the threat of a famine on a bigger scale than that seen in Ethiopia in the 1980s. The warning comes as Britain, Norway and the United States pledge millions of dollars at a conference in Oslo to help alleviate a humanitarian crisis. European Union antitrust regulators have charged HSBC, JP Morgan and Crédit Agricole with rigging financial benchmarks linked to the euro. The move followed a record €1.7 billion fine levied on six banks, including Deutsche Bank, Royal Bank of Scotland and Citigroup, last December. A man who travelled to Syria to join rebels fighting President Bashar al-Assad has become the first person in Britain to be convicted of a terrorism offence relating to the conflict. Mashudur Chowdhury, who's 31, travelled to the war-torn country with four others in October, but was arrested when he returned alone later that month. And US authorities have resumed a search for four British sailors missing in the Atlantic Ocean after an appeal from the British public and UK politicians. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. Welcome back to Midori House Live here on Monocle 24. The time now is 21:33, near enough, in Moscow, which will be 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, it's the turn of our man in Milan, Ivan Cavalho. Ivan, welcome to the programme.
Good evening, Andrew.
Italy, like Britain and like the rest of the continent, is braced for the EU elections. And I understand that a veteran comedian has been involving himself, but we'll talk about Berlusconi shortly. Beppe Grillo, meanwhile, has reappeared on Rai for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, indeed. After a self-imposed exile that has lasted about 20 years, he went on TV. He had told even members of his own party to not go on television, and he's expelled members of his party, the Five Star Movement, in the past for going on political talk shows. But he's decided with the run-up to the election that it was important to get on air and to talk to voters that he doesn't usually perhaps see at his rallies that he has in public squares. And so he went on Porta Porta, which is a very well-known talk show. It's considered by a lot of journalists as the third chamber of parliament because Bruno Vespa, this veteran journalist, is sort of the man who has all the connections. So we had a one-to-one conversation, and I have to say he was quite mellow for Beppe Grillo.
What is the current state of play with Griot's movement, Five Star? Because they appeared to be briefly a terribly big noise, and then the whole thing seemed to implode in not entirely unpredictable infighting.
Yeah, that is true. He's trying to, let's say, reach out to a base that he doesn't usually talk to because he's hoping to make up ground. He's about 7 points, 8 points behind if you look at the polls now going into these EU elections. And because he is the spokesman, I mean, no one in his party in the parliament, in both houses, members of his party, really have been able to stand out and speak on behalf of the movement, of course, because, you know, a lot of people say, you know, it is just him. He is this sort of autocrat. Berlusconi was throwing insults at him, saying, oh, he's a Stalin, he's a Hitler. And I think that's also partly why I think Grillo wanted to get on TV and to sort of shoot down some of these crazy remarks by Berlusconi. But, you know, he's sort of looking for a bit more momentum now because Renzi has taken away some of that in recent weeks.
You mentioned Berlusconi there. Is it? I mean, this will seem incredible, I think, to a lot of people outside Italy, or at least inexplicable. How is having Silvio Berlusconi campaigning on your behalf an advantage at this point?
No, it is curious that he is still out there. He's doing community service, but he is on television. He was on, of course, one of his channels because he does own Mediaset, the large television empire. A lot of people were saying that his recent remarks on television, he's kind of grasping at straws, and people are not expecting his Forza Italia movement to poll above 20%. I think Grillo might make up some of the gap on Renzi, perhaps in these last few days, but it looks like Berlusconi is. I don't think he'll breach that 20% at this point.
How are Italians expected to vote in the European elections? Is this going to be a protest vote going to the more extreme parties, as we were talking about earlier on the program, or do Italians take the European Parliament slightly more seriously than the British do?
I think that, you know, Italy, being a country that has been part of the European project for a very long time, a founding member, I think people will still go and vote for the major parties. I mean, Beppe Grillo's party is now considered protest, but also now on the political spectrum as an important party. You know, it was curious when Grillo was on TV last night, he was saying that, you know, look at the other protest movements out there, the extreme right in Greece, Le Pen in France. What he's saying is what he's offering is not as extreme, but one could argue, of course, against that. But I think Italians still believe in Europe. I think they're not happy right now. You might see a lower turnout. That may be something where people just decide that at this point they want to get the national economy in order and they're not too interested in Europe. But I don't think you'll see some of the extreme sort of movements on the fringe getting a lot of votes that you may see elsewhere.
Italy's economy is still going backwards, though.
Yeah, this was something that in the first quarter we had a dip back to -1% of GDP. Italy had seemed to have recovered from what was the longest post-war recession. Now we've seen this step back, and that is a concern. The stock market obviously took a hit for that, and that's something that Renzi has to address immediately, and it's something that, you know, he's offered a tax cut going into this election. He's putting out there about 1,000 euros in the pockets of people, low-income earners, and he's saying he's going to do this through tax cuts, about 10 billion. I'm not sure if he's going to be able to do that. Some of the people in the Senate, some of these committees are saying, you know, we don't see where you're going to get that funding with these cuts from in public spending. It may be a gambit for getting some more votes. We'll have to see.
Looking ahead, your hometown will next year be hosting the World Expo. It's not going terrifically smoothly, though, I understand.
No, Milan will be the host for this six-month event, which is starting next May. And just a few weeks ago, to celebrate this anniversary, this countdown, there was a slew of arrests of people organizing the World Expo. Something that if you talk to a lot of Milanese, they will say that it wasn't surprising because, you know, the earlier political corruption scandal, the Tangentopoli, the bribes bill that happened in the early 90s that brought down a lot of the traditional parties back then. There's still some of that sort of culture, the sort of corruption culture of kickbacks for public works contracts. And one has to remember that Italy still ranks very, very low on the index of transparency. If you look at corruption, these indexes by, for example, Transparency International, Italy is still about 69th on the scale. So it's way down if you look at it compared to its European partners. And this is something that is quite unfortunate, because they were looking to have a momentum going into this countdown, this final year of getting works in line. It has to be seen whether or not some of these are related to mafia infiltrating the public contracts. Over $1 billion is going to be spent by the state. It's something that Brenzi has immediately put an anti-mafia magistrate on the case to clean up immediately, because it's something they feel they have to take care of right away.
Another slightly concerning indicator about the first quarter or so of 2014 has been an uptick in the number of immigrants trying to arrive in Europe via the Italian island of Lampedusa. This is obviously an incredibly difficult and dangerous enterprise for these people, and large numbers of people have drowned in the last few years trying to make this trip, but still they come.
Yeah, this is an issue that Matteo Renzi raised just today, mentioning that he believes the UN needs to step in and actually set up some kind of refugee camp in Libya. We've seen the recent political violence in Tripoli. We've seen more immigrants coming through because you have unrest, of course, in Libya. You have the Syrian conflict, which is bringing in a new flow of people looking for safe haven. And, of course, Horn of Africa has also been a source of a lot of people looking to escape. And it's a problem that Italy is facing almost on its own. I mean, Frontex, which is the EU agency that's supposed to deal with border control, you know, it's based in Warsaw, and that's a bit ridiculous if you ask the Italians. They believe that needs to change, and there needs to be better coordination in the south of Europe, because this is where the problem is. But up to now, Europe hasn't really done much, except you know, from Brussels there's a few speeches of solidarity, but in terms of materiel, helicopters, warships, patrolling ships, there hasn't been much yet.
Ivan Cavaglio in Milan, thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we'll be assessing the differences between the Brazilian World Cup and the South African one. Stay tuned, we'll be back. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1842 in London. It's now just 23 days until Brazil kick off against Croatia to begin the 2014 World Cup finals. As Brazil has been discovering, however, the right to host a major international sporting event is a mixed blessing. Press reports of the preparations so far have focused less on beaches and samba and rather more on disorganisation, corruption and violent protests against same. However, the previous World Cup, South Africa's in 2010, was also held by an emerging economy and a country prone to corruption and violence, and was generally adjudged a success. So what has Brazil learnt from South Africa, and how have their preparations differed? I'm joined now by Peter Alegi, who has written extensively about football, including the book Africa's World Cup, Critical Reflections on Play, Patriotism, Spectatorship and Space. Peter, welcome to the show. Have you noticed key differences, any really important crucial differences between South Africa's preparations and Brazil's?
Well, it seems to me that South Africa was further along at this point, just a month away from the kickoff, or just about. All the stadiums were ready. They had been tested with full matches in front of capacity crowds, and that's not been the case in Brazil. The Corinthians' new stadium, the Itaquero in São Paulo, recently held a test, but not the entire stadium was used. And so I think that's one example, tangible example of the difference. If you look at the infrastructure as well, several of the airports in Brazil are not quite finished or refurbished completely, unlike the ones in South Africa. So I think in that respect, it seems that South Africa was perhaps better prepared than Brazil.
What specific things did South Africa do that Brazil hasn't and maybe should have?
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, each context is different. But what is for sure is that South Africa, when it won the bid from FIFA in 2004, was extremely eager to produce really what they called a world-class tournament. And so they invested enormous amounts of not just economic resources, as Brazil is doing as well, but also political and technocratic resources, human resources into this. You know, when South Africa was awarded the bid in May of 2004, I was in Soweto watching the proceedings on a big screen, and as Mandela entered the hall in Zurich, you know, we all held hands in Soweto hoping that South Africa would get the bid. And when it actually happened and Blatter pulled South Africa's name out of the envelope, people around me erupted in such joy that it seemed like South Africa had won the World Cup, not the right to host it. And several people said, this is bigger than the elections. Now imagine that. And I think that's a key difference. For South Africans, this tournament that was held in 2010 was a litmus test of what had been achieved since the end of apartheid. There was lots riding on it, and as a matter of national pride in particular, but also political pride. And I don't see that quite to the same extent in the Brazilian case.
Do you think there may be a certain degree of complacency with Brazil, that Brazil's just thinking, we're Brazil, it's the World Cup, how hard can it be?
Well, that's possible. I mean, South Africa, of course, hardly a world power in football, unlike Brazil, the great country of football, recognized by all as the best in the world. And so, you know, South Africa had more riding on this than Brazil in many respects. They had to prove, right, that they belong to the global community. So I think that was a big part of it. Also, Brazil didn't have any real legitimate contenders in the bid competition against it, unlike South Africa, which had, as listeners may remember, lost in very dubious circumstances to Germany the right to host the 2006 tournament and then just edged out Morocco. And so South Africa, I think, in that fierce competition over the course of two bidding wars for the World Cup, had really honed their machine. And I don't think that was the case in Brazil, and that possibly led to some complacency.
Why did we see, or why have we seen, so many more pre-tournament protests in Brazil, some of them quite violent, than we did in South Africa? The two countries, I mean, they have some similar problems. They're emerging countries. There's huge disparity between rich and poor, etc. Why was there not this kind of discord in South Africa?
Well, again, there was a lot riding on the World Cup for South Africans, and I mean ordinary citizens as well as the government. This was an opportunity that most people recognized, and I was in the country during the entire course of 2010. I saw this, you know, that there was a desire to challenge the negative image of Africans. There was a desire, an objective, to foster unity, a sense of we-ness and pride, to reawaken a kind of sense of Pan-Africanism. And people shared in this. And so there were some protests, incidentally, in South Africa, but they tended to be quite small and did not really rise to the level of what we've been seeing in Brazil. Again, South Africa is a young democracy. Apartheid only ended in 1994, whereas in Brazil, I think, you know, the situation is different. You have a middle class that's increasingly squeezed. Many local experts view the Brazilian case as one is almost like excessive taxation with little representation. And the World Cup is proving to be a catalyst of larger grievances. What's also interesting is that Brazilians seem to be comfortable with supporting their national football team, right, as we saw in the Confederations Cup of 2013, while simultaneously critiquing the political elite as well as FIFA. And I think that's quite interesting.
And just finally, Peter, when the World Cup was all over in 2010, what did it do for South Africa?
Well, I think emotionally it was a tremendous victory. It provided a real sense of upliftment, but unfortunately it was quite short-lived. In the end, I think the legacies, in concrete terms, are quite negative in the sense that the economics of the tournament, as the Brazilian case shows, are clearly flawed. Lots of public money spent for stadiums and infrastructure and very little accruing right to the national treasury. At the same time, FIFA is walking away with lots of tax-free profits, over $2.3 billion in the South African case. And the stadiums that were built for the South African World Cup, eight of them are not used regularly for professional football matches, and we're seeing the same danger of creating white elephants in Brazil. So I'm afraid that it's a bit of a mixed verdict, and we'll have to see how the Brazilian national team does, because I think a lot of the success of 2014 will turn on that sporting outcome.
Peter Alegi, author of Africa's World Cup, Critical Reflections on Play, Patriotism, Spectatorship and Space. Thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
It's a green thumbs up from us for Tokyo's leading flower market and auction, where merchants indulge in the business of buying blooms.
The Japanese flower market is the place for perfectionists. Anyone looking for a branch of cherry blossom just before it flowers, or a blemish-free orchid with every flower facing the same way.
Blooms or Bust, a photographic essay on the Otto Flower Market, now showing in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's just gone 18:50 here in London. That's 3:50 in Melbourne, 20:50 in Baghdad. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now for our music review. Today we're talking jazz with Mike Flynn, deputy editor of Jazzwise magazine. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hey, Andrew, how are you?
Very well. You've brought in three tunes, bits of which we will listen to. Without further ado, we'll start with the Neil Cowley Trio. Introduce them for us, if you would.
Certainly. Fantastic trio from the UK, been around for a few years. And this is a song from their most recent album. I think it's literally about to come out at the beginning of June. The track itself is called Sparkling and the album is called Touch and Flee.
OK, we can hear about a bit of that. This is Sparkling by the Neil Cowley Trio. The Neil Cowley Trio with Sparkling. Mike, I spent that waiting for somebody to go 1, 2, 3, 4 and then a fusillade of cannons.
It's quite ironic because Neil has been doing these, this is his fifth album, he's a brilliant pianist, worked with lots of people. He's actually famously worked with Adele on her 19 and 21 albums, playing on Hometown Glory and Rolling in the Deep. So he's a very widely listened to guy. He's known for sort of pounding chords and kind of doing, it's a sort of prog, acoustic prog rock, shall we say.
Does he wear a cape?
No, but sports a very fetching beard, I might add, and he'll be flattered by that reference to capes, I think. But ironically, we have a new, the next thing we're going to do, which I'll just go straight to, is Go-Go Penguin, who are a band from Manchester, who've kind of picked up Neil Cowley's mantle. Neil Cowley's sort of mellowing out a little bit, and it's a great album, actually. It's a bit of a grower, a bit of a slower burn, but the next track is by this band Go-Go Penguin, who are from Manchester, known for its dance music, known for its electronic sounds and club scene and all that. And these guys, three young guys, Chris Illingworth on the piano, Rob Turner on drums, Nick Blacker on bass, and this track is called Garden Dog Barbecue.
Well, they get maximum points from me for the song title and indeed for being called Go-Go Penguin. Let's hear a bit of it. Possibly not ideal background music for an operating theatre.
Well, that's why you'd keep the Neil Cowley album on standby, right?
That was Go-Go Penguin with Garden Dog Barbecue. They're clearly fond of the unusual time signature.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think this is what I wanted to bring in tonight was some piano trios that are essentially jazz musicians exploring other areas and kind of not doing obvious things, perhaps, with their instruments. If you listen to a classic jazz piano trio, you think Oscar Peterson or whatever your favourite jazz pianist may be. And I think, these Go-Go Penguin guys are really basically embracing a lot of the modern influences. They're kind of still in their sort of late 20s, early 30s, just acknowledging the fact that they like other music apart from classic jazz, you know?
Okay, well, the third track you've brought in tonight, this is Meliana. introduce them, if you would.
Yes, okay. Well, briefly, Brad Meldow is the keyboard player. He's a highly respected American pianist. He's been around for the last 20 years. He's the guy that took Nick Drake and Radiohead and basically turned them into vehicles for jazz improvisation and does a particularly fine version of River Man. Here, he's with drummer Mark Juliana, and hence the name Meliana, Meldow Juliana. And it's basically kind of live, progressive, funky dance music played on analog synthesizers and drums. So think Herbie Hancock meets Pink Floyd and good luck.
It sounds like this. That totally did sound like Herbie Hancock joining Pink Floyd. That was Meliana with Hungry Ghost, or a snippet thereof. It was the third and final selection tonight from our jazz reviewer, Mike Flynn, of Jazzwise magazine. Is there... It's always a temptation, I know, having been a music journalist myself, of sort of deciding that, you know, two artists is a coincidence, three is a scene. Is there actually a commonality between these artists you've brought in tonight, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, electronic music is having a profound influence on lots of different genres. And I mean, you know, for God's sake, you know, you've got everybody and their mother sort of trying to go dubstep. And I think, you know, there's definitely a correlation in jazz. I know a lot of, I mean, this band Snarky Puppy, who've been making a lot of headlines and winning Grammys, doing lots of tour dates. Again, they embrace kind of electronica and funk. And, you know, you talk to most jazz musicians. I mean, Neil Cowley actually has an electronic duo called Fragile State, and you would never know that it was him behind them, but they've been highly successful, and he worked with 07. So again, you know, I think there's definitely a kind of a thread that, you know, basically jazz musicians are stepping away from the conventions of the past, shall we say.
Mike Flynn from Jazzwise, we will have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, and that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to our special guests, Nina Schick and George Brock, and of course to Mike Flynn too, who we just heard from. Today's show was produced by Daphne Denis, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Harriet Baker, and our studio manager was Joel Church. Next up, a New York Design Week special edition of Section D. Tom Morris and his team will be dashing around the Big Apple to meet the designers and exhibitors and take the temperature of American design.
I mean, I think right now it wouldn't be a stretch to say that Brooklyn is really the creative center of New York. And that's not just in design, that's in a lot of different things.
I'll be back at 2200 London time with the Monocle Daily with me and Phil Hahn. And this show returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Muller, and thanks for listening.
From London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
at Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.